Well, welcome to chapter 8. The chapter begins once again with an exegetical insight, this time on 1 Corinthians 5:5. I appreciate that Mounts does these because kind of keeps us ramped up and ready to go, seeing that our Greek is immediately useful and helpful in exegetical work. I think one of the dangers that you can run into when you're learning a language, especially like Greek, is that you can sometimes get to the end of this and you get through a tough day and you're in the middle of the fog or the mud or whatever you want to call it, and go, why am I doing this? This is hard. You know, there's maybe a little bit of romance with it at the very beginning. Like, oh, this is cool. Like, I'm learning all those letters and it's kind of fun. But all of a sudden you get in the midst of all this grammatical stuff and also you're like, oh, man, do I really need to know all this? Well, there are some situations where knowing the Greek language is very, very helpful to an interpretation of a text. And truth be told, we've got a lot more tools at our fingertips than, you know, people of many years ago. I think about the time of the reformers and stuff. We didn't have the kind of tools that we have today. So you can get around pretty well with all the tools that are available. But still, what's wonderful about knowing Greek yourself is you have the ability to make judgments on different commentators' judgments. You've got the tools that are necessary to make judgments about their judgments. Otherwise, you're just kind of like, well, three guys say this and three guys say this. I'm not sure myself. It gives you the tools to be able to interact on a much deeper level with Scripture. And this is a great example from 1 Corinthians 5:5. This is a passage that I looked at a few years ago, actually, with the youth group. I was working through 1 Corinthians. I don't think I got about halfway through the book and then became senior pastor. So we stopped the study at that point and started something else with the adults. But I might return to 1 Corinthians sometime later. But this text, 1 Corinthians 5, is an interesting one. For one reason, because it describes something that a lot of churches aren't very faithful in doing anymore, and that is the whole process of church discipline. Today is considered a most hateful thing to even consider talking about kicking somebody out of the church. But meanwhile, this is part of biblical instruction. 1 Corinthians 5:5, we read there that Paul is talking to the church in Corinth. He says, I've decided to deliver such a one to Satan for the destruction of his flesh so that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus. Now that's reading from the NAS. So what I've given you is a handout that has the same exact description in the all these other different translations. You have the English Standard Version, the New King James, NIV, the King James, the Revised Standard, and then you have Young Living Translation down there at the bottom. The one that I want to particularly highlight here is the NIV. Look at the NIV rendering of this same expression. Hand this man over to Satan, so that the sinful nature may be destroyed and his spirit saved on the day of the Lord. Now, I've highlighted for you, do you see this? The word so that, and then the word and, there on the NIV translation. Go back up to the NAS. At the same places, you'll see that the word for is in the first place, and the second one is so that. Now, I want to draw your attention down to the box that I've got below that. And by the way, you're going to get real used to these little boxes. Get you in just a second, Chris. These little boxes with me. You'll see the inflected form, and then you see your case, number, gender, lexical form, inflected meaning. Now, in order to show you where these occur, go to the fourth line down, and you see the word there, ace. You see the word ace in the Greek box there? It says accusative right next to it. You'll see a blank there for number and gender because there is no number and gender with a preposition. This is a preposition, and it means for, translated most often for. Now, if you go down four or three more lines, you'll get to the Greek word hina, which you guys are already familiar with a little bit. This is a conjunction translated so that. Do you see that? Now, the point that I want to make here is what's interesting is the NIV translates this section so that, so the first ace there is being translated so that, the sinful nature may be destroyed and his spirit saved. We don't have a conjunction being translated there and rather than the conjunction so that. And there's a difference in meaning here. The NIV might tend here to communicate that the purpose of handing such a one over to Satan is so that the sinful nature may be destroyed and his spirit saved. All of these both being kind of jammed together as both the purpose for doing this. But what's interesting is if you translate, and you look at my rough translation underneath there, to hand over the such to Satan for destruction of the flesh so that the spirit might be saved in the day of the Lord. What's interesting here is that first word for destruction of the flesh designates results in Greek. So the result of handing such a one over to Satan is that the flesh be destroyed. That's the natural result. So there's an hand over to Satan, the flesh is going to be destroyed. But it's the Hina clause that gives us purpose. So the result of handing someone over to Satan is destruction of flesh. But what's the reason? The reason isn't merely just destruction of the flesh. What's the reason? So that the spirit might be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus. Bloomberg says this, or Blomberg says this, Paul's change of language is likely deliberative. Even if one of the results of his action is temporary exclusion and ostracism of the persistently rebellious sinner, Fee goes on to explain, what the grammar suggests then is that the destruction of the flesh is the anticipated result of the man being put back into Satan's domain, while the express purpose of the action is his redemption. The gist that's being communicated here is you do church discipline for redemptive purposes. Now, the immediate effect is destruction of flesh, but the overriding purpose of doing it is redemptive in mind. Now, what I would add to this whole discussion, by the way, is you have to also ask the question, what is the flesh and the spirit in reference to? And that becomes a whole other exegetical discussion. In particular, a lot of translators and interpreters have understood both the spirit and the flesh to be a reference to the person. I have some reasons that I can't go into tonight. I've actually got a copy of my notes from a sermon that I did, and if anyone's interested to look at it, you're welcome to look at it. But I have reasons to believe that really both the spirit and the flesh are references to the congregation. And I believe that church discipline is first and foremost a concern about the purity of the church. And some of my reasons for believing that are, number one, we don't have personal pronouns going on here. It doesn't say his flesh, and it doesn't say his spirit. It says the flesh be removed and the spirit be saved. This becomes a debate. You can discuss, and it is a Greek grammatical discussion. These are some cases where the article, can function more like a personal pronoun, like his. So it's possible. It's not impossible to translate that way. But if you read the rest of the context, and it, specifically, if you look at the context where it talks about a little leaven the whole lump, the surrounding context of 1 Corinthians 5, I believe, has more to do with the purity of Christ's bride, the church, corporately, than it even does about the particular individual. Now, that's not to say there's not a redemptive element regarding individuals. I think there's certainly that as well. But I think that the foremost concern in the Apostle Paul's mind is the example and witness of that congregation in Corinth to a watching world. Remember, the thing that he's questioning here is a man has his father's wife. The idea here is that you've got a man who's sleeping with his stepmother. And he says, this is an abomination. He says, this isn't even named among the Gentiles. He says, what you're allowing and applauding in the congregation is not even allowed among the Gentiles. I think his concern, well, most definitely, we see in 2 Corinthians, there might be an indication that that very one that was delivered over to Satan actually comes to repentance. And he says, receive such a one back in. By all means, if the person comes to repentance, then by all means, you receive him back in. But my point would be this. This is what frees church discipline from ever being a failure. Church discipline is never a failure if we've successfully removed the leavening influence from the congregation so that the spirit of the congregation, its witness for Christ, is preserved. Therefore, no matter whether that guy comes back or not, church discipline hasn't failed. You see, if the whole purpose of church discipline in the end is to redeem that person, what happens if the person never comes back to Christ? You'll be like, man, we failed. Why did we do this? Now this person's, you know, separated from the church. But ultimately, the point is, if they're separated from the church, they never come back. They went out from us because they were never really of us, right? So there can be a redemptive element here. And like I said, the discussion becomes even broader, and you discuss what are these, the flesh and spirit in reference to, and how do you understand that in the rest of the context? But the one I just want to make here is the purpose of conjunctions and prepositions become very important. And that's what we get a chance to talk about a little bit here tonight. Christy, do you want to say something else about this or a question? Okay. So let's talk a little bit this evening about some terms that we need to remember. He always starts us off in the chapter, here in chapter 8, page 55. He starts off the chapter with giving us, you know, English things that we need to remember. In particular, what is the definition of a preposition? Either tell me from memory or you can read to me. What is the definition of a preposition?
It describes two nouns, the relationship between two nouns that has to do with either temporal or spatial.
Okay, very good. So the most general thing that we could say about it is it describes the relationship that exists between two words. For example, the example he gives, the book is under the table. You know, the pen is on top of the table. Right? my homework is in the garbage can, right? This sort of thing. All of those, the preposition there, under or on or in, are all describing relationship between words. Now, the word that follows the preposition is known as the object of the preposition, and it's in the objective case in English. Okay, that's why we would say, if we were using pronoun, this word normally comes up the most in English, right? Because otherwise we don't inflect our words very much, right? I think garbage can, that can be subject, it could be the direct object, it could be the object of preposition. But when we use pronouns, it normally shows up a little bit more. So we would say something like, you know, a man is saved if he is in him, in Christ, you know, this sort of thing. And we wouldn't say in he, we would say in him, right? The objective case of the pronoun. So object of the preposition is always in the objective case in English. The whole thing together is called the prepositional phrase. Very good. Now, the one other thing that he mentions here for English purposes that's going to be addressed in this chapter is the predicate nominative. Now, the predicate nominative occurs whenever you have a linking verb. It's a unique situation when you have linking verbs where you'll have two words that are in the same case, or in the nominative case. Now, normally, remember, we would have some kind of construction where you'll have subject, you'll have verb, and then you'll have direct object, right? That's our normal kind of simple kind of sense that we come into. But when we have a linking verb, in other words, here it's the to be verb, right? When we have that, the potential exists for us to have subject, and then something like is, or was, or these sorts of, you know, any form of the to be verb, followed by a predicate nominative. Now, we also have predicate adjectives in English. So we say, like, God is holy. God is worthy. God is big. These kinds of constructions are constructions where in Greek we would definitely have, they both mean the nominative case. Nominative case. God is love. God is light. And sometimes even the to-be verb isn't even there. It's implied. But you'll find that the endings on both of those words will be in the nominative case. Okay? And we'll talk a little bit, I'll give you examples of those in just a few minutes. But remember, that's another thing in English that is good to keep track of. Now let's look at page 56, 8.3. The function of a preposition in Greek is the same as English. There's one very important fact, however, that you need to understand about Greek prepositions. In Greek, the meaning, if you get this, the meaning of a preposition depends upon the case of its object. He gives a good example here. The preposition dia means through if its object is in the genitive case, but it means on account of if its object is in the accusative case. Now, let me give it to you this way. There's some good news and bad news about prepositions in Greek. Let's start with the good news. We've already kind of mentioned some bad news, but let's mention the good news first. We see this down in 8.6. They're not inflected. Dia will always be dia. It never changes. It doesn't get endings. Doesn't get any of that stuff that we've been learning about. Dia is always dia. N is always N. Ace is always ace. Hoopa is always hoopa. All of these prepositions stay the same. They're not inflected. You're not going to be adding endings to them. No sigmas and nus and all of the rest. No iota subscripts. None of that stuff. You're not going to be inflecting prepositions. They stay the same. Okay? Now, that's the good news. Maybe what we could call the bad news, or just another thing to consider, is this whole thing that we just read in 8.3, that meaning is dependent on case of the object. Case of the object. So, and he uses the example dia. So what would happen is you find this word dia, and then you look at the word that follows it. And you want to look at the ending of the word that follows it. Because the ending of the word that follows it will tell you what the case of that word is, right? And this word could be the object of that preposition. And depending upon what case that is, dia can be translated differently. Now, not every preposition is that way. There are some that only always take their object in the same case every single time. N is a good example, meaning in. That's a good one to remember. N is in, okay? And it always takes, it always, it never changes. The object of it is always the same case. And I think you might even give that example in a minute. Look at 8.5. And by the way, he gives an example, he gives you a tip on flashcards. So whenever you memorize these, you want to memorize them. Look at 8.7 across the page. He gives an exact way that he would say to memorize this. We suggest you use blank with the blank means blank. So in other words here, end with the dative means in. By the way, end is always with the dative object. Always with the dative object. So it's always going to be, that's all you got for end. End with the dative is in, means in. End always means in. Okay, that's the one for that one. Okay. So there are some prepositions that always take their object is always the same case. But there are some idea that their meaning can change depending upon the object's case that they're with. So that's for flashcards. Now look back at 8.5. Key words. We learned earlier to use the keyword of with genitive and to with the dative. However, if a word is in the genitive or dative because it's the object of a preposition, we don't use the key word. Okay? So if you've got the preposition there, let's use, let's see, like via. And let's say that we had Chris do. Okay? Who ending tells us what case?
Genitive.
Genitive singular, right? Yeah. So genitive for dia means what? How do we translate dia in the genitive? We get 8.3. How does it translate when it's in the genitive?
Through.
It means through when its object is in the genitive. Very good. So here we translate through of Christ? No. Through Christ. The point is that that key word drops out once we have a preposition. Preposition trumps the key word. If you just saw Christu, you say of Christ. Genitive singular. Of Christ. Of is our key word. But when we have the preposition, preposition trumps key word goes away. We just have preposition with the object. And remember, this case being genitive means that this means would be translated through Christ. Now, if instead the object here was accusative, so we had Christon, dia Christon, then how would we translate it? Deal with the accusative is translated how?
Through.
On account of, right? On account of. So we translate here, on account of Christ. So if it's the new, it would be through Christ. If it's the new ending, it would be on account of Christ. Okay? That's really how prepositions work. That's all you really need to remember. Preposition always, it's always going to be dia. Dia is always going to be dia. It doesn't inflect, doesn't change its form. But you're always going to be looking at the object to determine its meaning in its particular case. And I'll give you some, we'll look at some prepositions in just a minute. The only other thing this chapter talks about besides prepositions is you get introduced to your first verb. And I know I told you, we're only doing nouns this semester. We're not doing verbs. Verbs we're saving until, next semester. And that's true, except for this one. He's going to teach you an irregular verb, but it's like one of those verbs that everybody needs to know, and you have to just memorize it. It's ame. Ame. Ame in Greek is the verb of being. It's the to-be verb. And by the way, you'll find this if you've learned other languages at all, the to-be verb is always like the strangest one. It's always irregular. I haven't found a language where it's not irregular. By irregular, I mean it's just kind of its own bird. It does its own thing. And you just have to memorize how it works. Okay? I know that I learned a little bit of Spanish from Jessica, and I found the same to be the case with that. It has its own way of doing things. So, you just have to memorize this chart. Now, look at 8.10. Formal study of verbs is deferred until chapter 15. However, one common verb worth learning right now is ame. Okay, look at 8.11. The basic part of a verb is called the stem. You guys are familiar with that already. The stem carries the basic meaning of the verb. Personal endings are added to the end of the stem to indicate person and number. There are three persons grammatically speaking. You can have first person. Can we give you the second one?
Third.
Second person? You want to give me the third one?
Third
person. Very good. First, second, and third person. Now, you guys are somewhat familiar with this. First person is what's the subject of a first person verb?
I.
Very good. This is the I. What is second?
You.
What's third?
He, she, and it.
Very good. He, she, and it. Okay. So, now, that's in the singular.
What about in the plural?
We.
What's first person plural?
We.
We. Very good. What's second person plural?
You.
Yeah, come on. We hear it down in Texas now.
Y'all,
right? We've got a word for that. The rest
you
of the
guys.
Country has just got problems, right? Yeah, yeah, they do. You guys. I'm actually originally a Yankee, so it's taken me a long time to grab hold of y'all, but don't use it very often. But it does have its purpose. Okay, so here we got the you plural. Technically, we usually just translate you, and like in our Bibles, it'll just be you. But if we had, maybe we should make an NAS Southern style and put in all the y'alls. Because it really is interesting. You guys have noticed me do that in sermons before, where all of a sudden, everything's been you plural. And all of a sudden, Jesus turns and says, I say to you. And it becomes singular. Instantly, you're thinking, who's he talking to? Whereas you don't notice that if you didn't see the Greek. Because in English, you, singular and you plural, is just translated you. So, y'all would be a good way of doing that in English. And then what's the plural third person?
They.
Very good. Very good. So, here's how it runs down. Hey, me is the first person singular, or first person, sorry, first person form of a me. A me you learn is the first person. And it means I am. I am. Okay? The second person is singular as a. It means you are. The third person, and you'll see here it's SD, and then you'll see the new is in parentheses. What that means is that new is movable. It's called a movable new. What it means is it can be there or not be there. It can be SD or SDIN. Either way, you'll recognize this is the third person singular of a me. The movable new, by the way, as it said there in 8.13, occurring at the end of the word, then it's a vowel when the following word begins with a vowel. Look at the example. Asin autoi. The purpose of adding the new is to avoid pronouncing two successive vowels. And think about it for just a minute. It is kind of hard to say. AC autu, right? A lot easier to say asin autoi. Sorry. So there are the movable new. And for our purposes, remember, I'm not going to ask you guys to be translating from English into Greek. You need to be able to recognize the Greek and translate it into English. Okay? So in other words, if you see something that says SD, or if it says SDIN, either way, you would translate there, he, she, or it, is. The plural varieties of these is Esmen, Este, and Asin. This is just one of those charts where, again, there's a few here, especially at the beginning of our studies, you just have to memorize and get used to. Ultimately, you'll get used to these just like you're getting used to the other charts. Okay. So we're talking about movable news. 8.15 talks about the predicate nominative. Indeed, just a second, Leah. Let's look at 8.15 and I'll get your questions. Predicate nominative there is the second function of the nominative case of the predicate nominative. Just as it is in English, a noun that follows a me is not receiving any action from the verb, but rather is telling you something about the subject. That's why we use predicate nominative. It's predicating something. It's saying it is here, almost functions, it's not exactly, but it almost functions like an equal sign. Equal sign. It's not exactly an equal sign, but it almost functions like that. It's predicating something about the subject. It's not saying the subject is doing something, it's saying something about the subject, right? Like, God is holy. This is a something about God. God's not doing something. He is something. So in these cases, both of those are going to be in the nominative case. And he gives an example here. Theos esten kurios. Here it is. God is Lord. You see how the endings of both of those are nominative? Os, os. Theos kurios. And it's joined with esten. Esten, remember? He, she, or it is. God is Lord. The context, by the way, will make clear here. First and last words are in the nominative case. Context makes clear which is the subject, which is the predicate. Remember, I told you before that one of the big indicators is if there's an article, and we're talking about this with, and the word was God, the article tells you which one's the subject. If one has an article and one doesn't, they're both nominative case. If the nominative word that has the article in front of it, that's your subject. Remember, it was Theos, Ein, Halagos. God was the Word. The Word was God, is how we translate. Because the, ha, is right before Logos, Word. If it went ha, Theos, Ein, Logos, then it would be the God was Word. Okay? But because the happens before the Logos, that becomes our subject. Okay? Those grammatical rules.
Look at the tips on translation here. Oh, Lee, you had a question.
Yeah, how do you know on the Amy, the ones that have the rough breathing at the beginning?
There's no rough breathings, all smooth breathings.
Oh, yeah.
These are all smooth breathings, okay? I'm sorry, if I didn't write this very well, they're all smooth breathings.
No, I wouldn't, I'm tired
of it. Okay, all smooth breathings, cool. All smooth breathings.
Sorry.
8.16 gives one example here. You can see halagos erketai aston kosmon. Here we have the Word, and it gives you here goes, and then you see here aston kosmon into the world. And you see that's accusative case, but you wouldn't just translate this goes the world. You would include your prepositional phrase here, goes into the world. Yeah, and here's another example. Look at 8.17. It says, Greek also regularly drops the article of prepositional phrases. If it fits in the context, you may put it back in. So here you have halagos erketai eis kosmon. So the only difference between this and the above is we've lost ton, which is the, right? The article. Sometimes that just gets dropped out when you have a preposition. So you're welcome and free to reinsert the article for English sake in order to make the translation smoother in such cases. Okay, look at page 60 with me. He does a little summary. That's all the new stuff we're learning here, besides some vocab. And he gets a little chart on page 60, which is just excellent. This chart is really good. It'd be really good material to know. I think it would be good to know this for next week. This chart. Hint, hint. Okay, so this chart has a indication, kind of spatially, of how these prepositions function. And you kind of remember this spatially. Sometimes we like pictures, and this picture is somewhat helpful in remembering how these prepositions work. You see pros there, with the arrow pointing toward the circle? That's what that means. It means to or toward. You see apa, there to the far right, top? You see how it's pointing away from the circle? That usually translated from. We have ace, you see how the arrow goes all the way into the circle? Ace, usually translated into. Ek, you see how that preposition goes from the circle going out? Out is usually, or out of. You see how dia cuts right on through the circle? Dia would often be translated through. And then you see n is inside the circle, so it would be in. And hupa is under the circle, so it would be under. And para is beside the circle, so it would be something like beside or alongside. He gives the formal definitions of all of these here to follow. Let me give out the vocab list. Let me read off these quickly to you.
What was the first one, toward?
Yes, toward or to. And I think that all of these are also going to show up in your vocab list if you haven't already learned them. So let's go through them together quickly here. First word there that you find is Allah.
Allah.
Or Allah. Allah. See that? Allah.
Allah.
You also see that sometimes it can, through elision, drop that final alpha and just be all. It means but, yet, or except. This is a more emphatic but, by the way, than de. You guys learn de? De, a lot of times, is but it can also be and now. Allah is a lot stronger contrastive conjunction. If you see an Allah, you're going to say but, yet, except. It's going to be contrastive conjunction. De is kind of a weird guy, because he can be sometimes contrastive, and sometimes it's just additional, like and. Sometimes you translate de, like and. Remember, the one that's the big and is chi, right? But Deg can kind of go both ways. Allah is most definitely contrastive. Kai is most definitely, you know, additional. Apa.
Apa.
Can y'all say it with me? Apa.
Apa. Apa.
Very good. It ought to be op or af. And this is always in the genitive. Apa is always comes with the genitive, and it means away or away from or from. Okay? And you can kind of see that on your little circle chart. Dia.
Dia.
Or D. Again, you see you're dropping vowels here depending upon what the word that follows it has. If the word that follows it starts with a vowel, it will drop the vowel from the end of this preposition. Okay, so apa becomes up. Now you see how else you have there af. A lot of times that will change to that if you have a rough breathing. So you not only have the, remember rough breathing only happen over a vowel. But if you have a rough breathing, sometimes you'll see that even the consonant will change. And again, you don't have to be able to do that. You just have to be able to recognize it. So if you see a pa or ah or ah, you know that you're looking at a pa, meaning away. Okay. So dia, or dia, which you guys already said, means with the genitive means through, and we already looked at this example, and the accusative means on account of. Now here's a good example. There in the chart, you see dia cutting right on through the circle. That means through. Remember, that's only with the genitive. But the accusative, it means on account of. Amy.
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 Very good. It means I am, I exist, I live, I am present, and we've already conjugated that one. Let's see here. We've got ek.
Ek.
Or ex. This is from or out of. It comes only with the genitive. Hemera.
Hemera.
Hemeras. Here's the word means day. It's day. Ain.
Ain.
Now, this is an example of a word that, this is a me, believe it or not, that's happening in another tense. And all you need to know right now is just memorize it, because it happens quite often. So it just means he, she, or it was. Okay? And we already looked at that in our example, right, in John 1. Theos, ain, halagos. The word was God. So now you know that word ain means was. Okay. Thalassa. Or thalassa. this means sea or lake. Sea or lake. By the way, guys, and I didn't get you a real long time. This is another discussion, Trino and Chris, and it's a little bit longer. We talked about it a little bit last time. You'll notice there that thalassa also then has, you see in the genitive ending, thalassais. You see that? We have the alpha eta shift there, guys. Okay? Here's a word, Kathy. I think you were asking about that. Here's one of those word examples. If you can read about this in the last chapter, you'll find there's a point about it. There's a couple of words that, and there's only four major ones that happen with any frequency in the Greek, where even though that final vowel stem, the vowel of the stem is an alpha. And normally, you remember, you just go alpha all the way down the chart. Remember? If you have graphe, remember the eta becomes an alpha down below. But like with hamartia, that alpha is all the way down. Well, there's a rule that if that alpha, the letter that's immediately preceding it, is not an iota, an epsilon, a rho. I think those are it. I think those are the three. Okay, I've got some people that are aware of the rules. They keep me on track here. If it's one of those, then it stays alpha all the way down. But if it's not, then when it gets to the genitive and dative, the weird condition, it switches to that eta. The eta shows up right in those two spots, which is actually somewhat helpful, because remember, the one tricky guy is the genitive singular and the accusative plural in that feminine, and right there it's going to be eta, and down below it's going to be alpha. So you'll be able to distinguish between the genitive singular and the accusative plural. You see that the letter right before the alpha is a sigma. So that's the reason why it gets the eta shift. Eta here, alpha shifts to eta. And that's why, by the way, guys, this is the reason why Mount has you memorize these with their genitive endings. This is a good example. Oh, now you know that's one of those alpha-eta shifts. Okay? If you knew the rule, you'd already know it. But this way it makes it really emphatic. Thanatos. This is death. It's death. Hina.
Hina.
We looked at this one tonight. Remember, I was in 1 Corinthians 5:5. In order that, Hina is prefaces a lot of purpose clauses. So that, and then usually the verb that follows it is in the subjunctive mood. This is all bonus. Using the subjunctive mood, you have something like this. It'll be a construction like, so that he might save them. It'll be in this verb that says might. So it describes purpose. He did this so that, Hina, and there'll be something in the subjunctive mood often is a verb that follows it. We'll talk about that later on. But the point here is that Hina demonstrates purpose. It's usually the thing you connect with Hina clauses. Ioannes. This is John. This is John. This will be the, if you had a Greek New Testament, you'll find this at the title of the Gospel of John. You'll find it kind of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John also. Lego.
Lego.
Here's a verb. It means I say or I speak. Remember this one, Lego my ego. I say and, or I speak. Meta.
Meta.
Here you have met and meth. Again, those remember endings, if you have a vowel following it, it becomes met. If you have a rough breathing following it, it becomes meth. With the genitive, it means with. With the accusative, it means after. By the way, often you'll see this as the with. Usually it's in the genitive. Every once in a while, it doesn't occur in the accusative. And interesting, I remember this one in particular because Aristotle had written a book that was called Physics, and then he wrote a book called Metaphysics, after the physics. And we use the word metaphysical to talk about something that's beyond the physical, right? Beyond, you talk about something that's kind of spiritual or philosophical, we talk about a metaphysical reality. After is the way that we use that word meta. So you use it after or with, depending upon the object, the case of the object. Oikia.
Oikia.
And then you'll see also here oikos.
Oikos.
Both of those mean house or home. One is feminine, one is masculine. Here's one of those odd situations where you've got both the feminine and masculine version of them. Again, you don't have to know when you have to use them. All you need to do is be able to identify it. Okay? Aklos. This means crowd or multitude. I always think of an ox running through a crowd. Aklos, okay? Para.
Para.
Para. This means in the genitive, from, in the dative, beside or in the presence of, in the accusative, alongside of. You'll see the dative and accusative are very similar to each other. I mean, beside and alongside, very similar. But the genitive case there, from. So this is one of those odd ones where we've got actual three meanings depending upon what the object follows it with. Parabole.
Parable.
It should be known well to you, right? That's parable, exactly. Mm-hmm. Pros.
Pros.
And we have that one on a chart. It means to or towards. It also can mean with. Hoopa.
Hoopa.
And then you'll also see those other versions, hoop and hoof. This is genitive. In the genitive means, so object following in the genitive means by. If that's an object in the accusative, it means under. And you'll see that on our circle chart also. So remember that under means with the accusative. And also, just to remind you, we had a couple previous prepositions we already looked at. Ace. Ace. It happens with the accusative, meaning into, in, or among. And en always comes with the dative, meaning in, on, or among. Now, with those prepositions, you've got... I think 2/3 of all the major prepositions, and those are really the big ones. So you're well on your way to being able to identify and recognize prepositional phrases. And there's a whole lot of them in the Bible. Okay, a whole lot of prepositional phrases. So very good to be familiar with these prepositions. Really great news. If you know all the memorize all the vocab up through this chapter, you know one out of every two word occurrences in the Greek New Testament. I mean, you go open up the Bible, you know one out of every two. 50% of the word occurrences there, you should be able to recognize. That's pretty cool. The number you'll start to see real quickly starts ramping down. It doesn't, it starts to get more progress. It's gonna get slower. You know, it's not like, oh wait, just 8 more weeks and we've got them all. No, there's a lot more once you start getting up there. He's doing, remember, all of the most used words are happening here very early on. You're getting familiar with those. But still, over it's a 51.48% you know, 71% or 71,000 of the word of the 138,000 word occurrences in the New Testament. So be encouraged. Up to now, if you've learned all the vocab, it's 72 words. Only 72 words, and you know, one out of every two words in the Greek New Testament. I think that's pretty cool. Can I just point you to one other thing before I dismiss, or if you have any questions, is if you haven't already seen this, I think I might have pointed this out last time, go to the back of the book, those great ages, and there's an appendix that I show this to you. Refer you to it again, because there's a lot of great stuff back here, especially with what we just did. For example, prepositions. Look at page 339, the very beginning of those gray pages. Look familiar? Page 339? There's your chart. There's the circle chart. He's also got a couple added there. You'll see who pair up above there means above. Epi means upon, so it's upon the circle. Peri means around, so it's kind of sitting there on the kind of around there. So anyway, those are the only ones I think that are added on that. You don't have to remember, you're not responsible for those yet, but it's at least familiarizing those words are right there. And then he has other prepositions that are not spatially diagrammed underneath it. Some of those you've learned so far, some of them you haven't. Remember, you've learned about 2/3 of them so far. But that's kind of the master preposition chart, which is kind of cool. So you're familiar with that. At least you know it's there. And then if you go to page 342, I already showed you this Greek cases. You've now learned that the nominative case can be subject of the verb, and you also just learned tonight, look at little b there. It can also be the what?
Is.
Yeah, the predicate of is, right? The predicate nominative, okay? And so you've also learned with the genitive and dative and accusative, what you've learned so far is the possessive, A, you see that? Under dative, it's the indirect object, and under accusative, you learned A, direct object of verb. But now you've also learned B under each of those, right? The genitive can be an object of preposition, the dative can be an object of preposition, and the accusative can be object of preposition. You see that? So we're filling in this chart here, the usages of these cases. This is also a great chart to have in mind. The next page is your master ending chart. You don't have to worry about third declension there on the far right. We'll talk about that in chapter 10. But the left chart, you already know. Right? Piece of cake. Everybody got that now, right?
Okay.
And then the first, you'll see the 9 nominal rules underneath it. You guys have learned the first 6, right? Okay. And then the article is on page 345. Very top there. There's the article you guys have already learned. So, and then, let's say, if you just go a little bit further, you should be able, I was thinking that the AME is in here too.
It is there.
Where is it? What page?
He has a different book.
352.
Oh, okay. You have a different page number here, so. Oh, there it is. 362, top of the page. You've only learned the present.
Yeah.
So all you have to worry about is the very far left top thing there, okay? Amy, Eston, Esmond, Este, Aeson. Okay? So anyway, kind of cool charts there at the end. I'll mention one other thing is if you want to spend the extra money for it, you certainly don't have to, but maybe you've seen these online. He's got another study tool that he's got. I'm just pushing all of Mounce's materials. But anyway, alphabet, you guys have learned. Here's the definite article. You got relative pronoun, we haven't learned yet. First and second declension nouns, he's got those there. Here he has case endings and the rules. And then you'll see there's the prepositional chart. So what this is, and then it goes on to a whole bunch of other stuff, but this is kind of a neat little laminated deal. Now you can make your own, you know, to have this, and you've got them all in the appendices. So it's not adding any information. It's just all kind of at a glance kind of thing. And he's selling these online also. So just, you know, they are there if you're curious about them. Any questions? Maybe you want to know what your homework is?
No.
You don't want to know what that is? Okay, go ahead, Jack.
For some more good news, can we count on word order for prepositional phrases?
Yes, yes. Okay. Yes, yeah, prepositional phrases, you'll have the preposition and then you'll have the object following it. So yes, absolutely. Yeah, there are cases like this. The same thing with adjectives. You'll find adjectives will be next to the thing, just like the article. The article will be with the thing that's modifying. It's not going to be one of these things where it's like, oh, is this article with which of these words? So that's the only case where you go, you know, word order has some significance in those kinds of situations. You'll just be looking at the words right along around the thing that's at.
So it's after, too, right along.
Yes, it's going to be after, exactly. It'll be after the preposition, absolutely, just like in English. Homework, make sure you reread over this chapter. If you haven't already read it, then read it. If you've already read it, read it again. Make sure that you've memorized Amy, present tense here that we've just gone over. Make sure that you know the prepositions, how they function, know the grammar of prepositions, know that spatial chart, okay? Know your vocabulary. Be ready for a quiz on the grammar and the vocabulary next time. And for homework, other than that, remember, the key to doing this, I'm telling you, the key to doing well in here, would you guys agree with me, those of you who have done this way? Learn the grammar and the charts first. Memorize those first. Then go to the workbook and work the workbook without cheats. Don't use, if you got no cards and stuff, great. Do all that work. Get it in your brain and then go to the workbook and put all the cheats aside. Because when you take my quiz, I'm not giving that to you, right? Or you can just say, hey, before I start doing it, I'm going to reproduce the chart and then I'm going to work off that. That's fine too. But what I really encourage you to do is get that stuff memorized. And then when you go to the workbook, use your workbook experience as a chance to go, what do I not know? What am I not remembering? What are the ones that are, you know, I'm getting stuck on? What is this omega nu? What is that thing? I keep forgetting it. Oh, yeah, genitive plural. You know, doing that sort of thing, okay? So do your memory work. Do all of that first. Then go to the workbook. Do that after you've done your memory work. Does that make sense? So that way the workbook becomes like an exercise in trying to see if you might have to crutch the whole way. I mean, the whole point of learning the language, anybody can buy an expensive program, do a mouse over, and it'll tell you all the stuff, you know? But the whole purpose of learning this is so that way you actually know it. And I'm telling you, if you don't get it in your brain, you won't use it. It just won't be useful. Because if every time you open up the Greek New Testament, every single word you come to, you have to go and look up, it's just not useful. You'll get tired of doing it. You will stop reading the Greek New Testament. So you've got to get that vocab memorized. And you've got to get those endings straight in your head. Then go to the workbook. Do the workbook as much as you can. Things you get stuck on. Then go and refresh your memory. Then come back to the workbook again. Okay, that's how I would do that. That way you know how you're doing. Otherwise, you have no idea. Okay, anybody can sit there with the book open and just kind of like do a hunt and find. But you won't be reiterating what you're learning. Okay, memorize and do the workbook. So do the workbook for chapter 8. Right, do the workbook chapter 8. And we'll take a quiz on all of that next time. Any final questions? Yes, Chris.
We're responsible for the prepositional chart in the in here, not the.
Yes, exactly. Yes. The prepositional chart is in the chapter. Is the one that I'm going to hold you accountable for, not the one in the back of the book. Because yes, we haven't learned all those prepositions yet. Good question. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much. God bless you. See you next week.